Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Share Talk Radio. I'm your host, Beth Kling, Communications Director at Share. In each program, we talk to advocates, doctors, and people living with breast and ovarian cancers about topics of interest to this community. You can learn more about Share's free services at www.sharecancersupport.org. At this point, I'm going to turn this entire program over to Ivis Sampaio, Senior Director of Programs at Share. Hi, Ivis.
Hi, Beth, and thank you. We're here today with three doctors from NYU Cancer Center to talk about DCIS, a hot topic in the news these days. We'll be talking to doctors Deborah Axelrod, Julia Smith, and David Kleinberg. Dr. Axelrod is Director of the Clinical Breast Program and Services and Medical Director of Community Cancer Education and Outreach at the Laura and Isaac Perlmutter Cancer Center and a board-certified surgeon who specializes in breast diseases and breast cancer. She is also a member of Share's Board of Directors. Dr. Julia Smith is the Clinical Director of the Cancer Screening Program at the Laura and Isaac Perlmutter Cancer Center and the Director of the NYU Bellevue Lynn Cohen Foundation and Caring Together Project for Women with Increased Risk for Cancer. Her interest is in risk assessment for cancer with the goal of increasing surveillance, early detection, and prevention. Dr. David Kleinberg is a professor of medicine and the director of neuroendocrine unit at the NYU School of Medicine. He and his colleagues forged new ground in the understanding of the hormonal control of mammary and prostate development. Together with his colleagues, Deborah Axelrod and Julia Smith, Dr. Kleinberg has been making progress in finding novel treatments for atypical hyperplasia and ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, based on blocking IGF-1 action. Before we get started, I want to introduce Deb Hackenberry, who was treated for DCIS and is the facilitator of Share's DCIS support group. Deb and I will be posing questions today, and we will allow for questions from our listeners afterwards. So let's get started. First, I'd like the doctors to define DCIS and how it has changed over the years.
So I am going to answer that question. It's Deborah Axelrod. Intraductal cancer, you know, it has many names. It's intraductal cancer or DCIS or ductal carcinoma in situ, stage zero breast cancer, and it all means the same. When I talk to patients, I tell them that intraductal cancer means that if you look at a duct like a cylinder and lining that cylinder is cells, the cancer that has occurred is the cancer that lines that cylinder and it hasn't gone outside of the surrounding area. You know, most intraductal cancer is picked up by calcifications on a mammogram these days. We're not talking about before the advent of mammography, and I'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, we are now picking it up usually as calcifications, probably more than 85%, 90% of all intraductal cancer is you can't feel it. And it's not the calcium that's the cancer. See, a lot of people think that. They think they're too much calcium in their diet. But it's the calcium in the duct that leads you to do the biopsy that shows you the cancer cells around the calcium or lining that duct. And if it hasn't penetrated the basement membrane, it's called intraductal cancer. If it's outside of the basement membrane, then it's invasive cancer. And most cancer that we pick up is invasive cancer. But about 20% of cancers that we're picking up now are intraductal cancer. And that's so different than in the early 80s, when we were picking up about 3% of all our cancer was intraductal cancer. So it has significantly increased. And a lot of the controversy, which we will all talk about, is, just some of the recent information that came out about whether or not all DCIS needs to be clinically treated. So it's really changed over the years and significantly changed, but does it warrant significant treatments? I think that that's your hopefully that helps answer the question.
Thank you, Dr. Axelrod. My second question is, how is DCIS classified, and is all DCIS alike?
Maybe I'll take that one. This is Julia Smith. Well, that is exactly sort of the crux of the issue now, is all DCIS alike? We've actually known for a long time that all DCIS, just like all breast cancer, is not alike. In the olden days, meaning 15 years ago, everybody said, well, I have breast cancer, and thought that was one disease. As we've come to understand much more about the molecular biology and the genetics of breast cancer, we have come to realize that breast cancer is a combination of many, it's an umbrella category for many diseases. That is turning out to be true for DCIS too. So there are different histologic, cellular, pathologic, and molecular features that can be picked out now that can help us start to understand what classification the individual patient's DCIS falls into. So it is not all alike. It does not all have the same portent the same implications for treatment or for prognosis, just like all breast cancer is not alike.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smith. My third question is DCIS a different disease across various ages, and are there racial differences?
So I think that, Julia, you and I should probably step in here. And now I think what you're talking about is really the recent study. So before we talk about that, there have been many studies over the years looking at why intraductal cancer behaves the way it does. Does it behave differently? And as Julia Smith talked about, it varies according to like the different pathologic classifications. So that if you have a component of comedonecrosis, usually goes along with intermediate or high grade DCIS, you may be at a higher risk of developing an invasive recurrence in that breast. And then looking at younger women in some studies showed that it was more aggressive and there was more of a risk of the cancer coming back as invasive cancer and the grade of the cancer being different and affecting recurrence. And even Dr. Mel Silverstein in a study that he then later classified as the Van Nuys Prognostic Index said that if you looked at across all of these different classes of tumor size, of DCIS, the grade, the margins, the age. If you found that there was a low classification, I think there were about like four numbers in each classification across four different classes of what I that you would be able to predict who would not need radiation, who would need radiation, and who should have a mastectomy.
Right.
It was even though it was not a randomized study and not a prospective study, it showed that if you paid attention to the margins, if you paid attention to the grade, the histology, that it could help you guide whether or not you would recommend radiation or just lumpectomy or mastectomy versus lumpectomy radiation, which seems to be the general choice of traditionally for women diagnosed with DCIS.
Right. So what Deborah's getting at here is we think is really the main issues now with DCIS, and this Van Nuys study that she's talking about with looking at things like the tumor size, the kind of pathology that is seen, the width of the margins, that helped trim down our understanding of who falls into what classification. All the time since DCIS was discovered, the pathologists have told us that there is what's called low, intermediate, and high grade DCIS. We've known for a long time that the cells in different DCIS specimens are different. And what we're starting to pick out now, and what Deborah is talking about, is exactly what we're dealing with, you know, at the current time, is that these other issues, these other factors can predict mortality, and that will determine treatment for DCIS. So as Deborah said, the grade, is it poorly differentiated or is it well differentiated? When what that means is that the pathologist looks under the microscope at the cell, the DCIS cell, and says, okay, this cell, this DCIS cell looks a lot like the original ductal breast cancer, breast cell, breast ductal cell, normal. That's called well differentiated. If the pathologist looks at it and says, this DCIS cell doesn't look anything like a normal breast cell, breast ductal cell, then they say it's poorly differentiated. And then there's one in classification in the middle called intermediate. And that is what we're talking about with grade. Turns out to be quite important in helping us understand who needs what kind of treatment and what the implications are on prognosis is. And then, as Deborah said, the other issues are also important. The size of the tumor. How big is the DCIS? What's the chance that there's going to be, when you actually, if you take it out, there's actually going to be a little microinvasion breaking through that basement membrane that Deborah mentioned before. Where is there evidence of what she described as comedonecrosis, meaning that the cells are growing fast enough that they outstrip their blood supply, so there's little tissue death in there. And then we find out that there are other important things like the estrogen receptor status, the HER2 status, and other biologic things in addition, like ethnicity and age of diagnosis. So it's a complicated calculus, and it's very important to take all of these things into consideration when we're going to make an assessment about what the prognosis is and what impact we can have with different treatment options.
Well, I think that leads into our next question is, what is the treatment and why is there controversy about the treatments?
Deborah, you should take this one.
Well, you need like a few weeks to answer. Actually, it's going to be hard to answer that question. First of all, there are no randomized trials between mastectomy versus lumpectomy and radiation, so we've extrapolated that mastectomy versus lumpectomy with radiation work for invasive cancer, so it should work for non-invasive or intraductal cancer. So that was kind of like the basis for looking at studies about treatment. Looking at studies of how to treat DCIS. So they looked at lumpectomy and radiation, which would be the standard, versus lumpectomy without radiation therapy. And there were no survival differences. As a matter of fact, in a new study that was just published by Steve Narod, he found that the mortality rates did not vary with any specific treatment. And that kind of shakes things up because we've, for a long time, been talking about radiation therapy being given to reduce the risk of an invasive recurrence. And in many studies, we know in the large NSABP, or National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project study, and the EORTC study, that giving radiation therapy significantly decreases the risk of an invasive recurrence for someone with DCIS getting conservative treatment, getting a lumpectomy. Getting radiation therapy would decrease their risk of cancer coming back as invasive. And many people think that if you have an invasive recurrence, that should negatively affect your survival. But the overall survival is no different. People who had an invasive recurrence are more likely to die of breast cancer than people who don't. But preventing that invasive recurrence doesn't prevent the death from breast cancer. And that was the conclusion of the study by Steve Narod. And that shakes up a lot of what we feel in the medical community has been the standard choice for the treatment. And we do have different protocols that look at whether or not we could conservatively just excise the DCIS without radiation therapy. And if you, you know, if you pick your patient carefully, people do very well, you know, without ever having a recurrence without radiation. But this is a significant study with a significant editorial by Laura Esserman that really shakes things up about looking at really the what's the biologic significance of intraductal cancer and not the mechanics.
What is the overtreatment, as one hears so frequently now in the media?
Well, as a breast surgeon, people come in and they, you know, there are reasons to do mastectomy for intraductal cancer. For instance, someone who has intraductal cancer in different quadrants, that would be someone that I would recommend have a mastectomy. But women are coming in and they're wanting to have both their breasts removed. And I, you know, Julie and I talk about this a lot, about what risk really means. And, you know, it's also a philosophical question about, you know, if you remove the healthy breast, sure, you have a 95% less risk of developing cancer in that breast, but does it impact your overall survival? And if you understand that it doesn't, then what are you doing it for? Well, you know, people are doing it for symmetry. They're doing it so that they don't have the anxiety of future imaging. But it's not making your, you know, it's not making you live longer. And I think Julie can speak to this as well, because maybe there are some questions about rethinking this. Maybe in the future, maybe this is something that really needs to be studied about overtreatment. Is it overtreatment, or are you impacting the future risk? But to date, people who want to just remove a healthy breast, it's pretty much overtreatment. And as long as someone is well aware and informed that it doesn't, you know, make you live longer, then maybe they can make a better or educated decision after a, you know, a balanced discussion with their treating physician. And that often, you know, people come in and say, take my breasts off. I never, ever, ever want to have to worry about breast cancer again. You know, it's overtreatment for most people.
May I ask a question? Hello?
Yes. Sure.
This is David Kleinberg asking this question. I'm wondering, Deborah and Julia, from my reading, I get the sense that anybody who has DCIS might be sent for removal, or not even a mastectomy, but just a debulking of the tumor, radiation, and possibly the CIRMs. Is that what most people do, or are there people who don't get all of those treatments at the same time?
Well, this is Julia Smith. Well, I think that, you know, that, as Deborah mentioned, you know, before, that is, yes, that is, has been the classic traditional approach, and that developed because there were studies, good studies, showing in invasive cancer that survival could be changed with that kind of treatment. But it's also been true that for those of us who treat DCIS and breast cancer, over the last decade, it's become very clear that, as we said in the beginning, there is DCIS and there is DCIS. So we know, as Deborah mentioned, we know that it's very clear that if you do radiate after a lumpectomy, you will reduce the chance of an in-breast recurrence. If you give tamoxifen, then you will reduce the chance of an in-breast recurrence, and you will reduce the chance of a contralateral breast cancer. So this has been shown to be true. It still remains true, and we know that is something we can affect. But what has changed over the last really 5 to 10 years is that since we've been able to pick out these subsets of patients who are not going to have their survival or their breast recurrence or their invasive risk changed, that we have been able to offer some of the women lesser therapy. And as Deborah said, it has to be on an extremely individualized basis. You have to evaluate each of these factors that we're talking about for each case and then have an extensive and full discussion with the woman about her understanding of what the implications are for recurrences, for further imaging, for risk, and for treatment options. So the answer to your question, David, is yes, most people who have been treating this, for a long time have adjusted their algorithms about the options for choice, but it has to be in the context of each individualized case. I wanted to make one other point also that was raised, that comes up, and that is that since I focus a lot on risk, it is also important to make sure that for each individual woman who's deciding about these, she has a very comprehensive, analysis of her risk in general, because there are things that can affect how you choose to handle this and what your risk is, even given the molecular subsets. So when we talk about, a young woman who has a strong family history and develops a DCIS early in life, that's something to take account of. If she's had other evidence of breast pathology, that's something to take account of. If there is a genetic mutation, and we know now that it's not just the BRCA mutation, we now have many genes that we can identify that we know confer some increased risk of various cancers, including breast cancers, those are factors to take into account. So what the hormonal status has been, what her lifestyle choices are going to be in the future, what her needs are, and her emotional and psychological approach. So these are also things that we have, factored in and have to continue to factor in deciding about how to treat the individual.
And I think it's also important to keep in mind that overall people who have a diagnosis of intraductal cancer have a very low, low, low risk of dying of breast cancer, probably
right.
on the order of
3%.
Right. And so it's never an emergency. It should always be thought out. And, and the more information, the better. It's just that some information can be very confusing, especially if someone is not guiding you.
What are the current results of published trials?
Well, so, I talked about the NSABP, the National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project, the results of that, and the EORTC, the results of that, looking at radiation therapy and what radiation therapy, the benefits of radiation. And the benefits are that it does reduce the risk of an invasive cancer. We looked at adding tamoxifen, and it does reduce the risk of a contralateral or cancer in the other breast, reduces the risk of an invasive cancer as well in that breast. But it does not. But we are looking with particularly with radiation, the overall survival is not improved, and I think that this is something that people ought to understand. And when I talk to people about going for radiation therapy after a lumpectomy, I do say that radiation does not improve overall survival. What it will do, it'll decrease the risk of cancer coming back as invasive. So I think people are pretty surprised by that, that it doesn't, help them survive longer, doesn't help prevent them from dying of a breast-related event. And I think that that's important to know. But I believe that in the next few years, there's going to, you know, there's going to be a, you know, metamorphosis of how we treat cancer in general and how we look at it.
What are some of the newer trials and what is going on in the lab to better understand which DCIS has to be treated?
I think that maybe you're asking me to give my opinion. I'm a non-oncologist. I'm an endocrinologist and a pituitary endocrinologist. But I've been involved because of my knowledge of the action of hormones in the breast, and we know that not only estrogen and progesterone have important effects on the breast, but that there's another hormone called IGF-1, which underlies the actions of both of those other hormones. If you have an IGF-1 deficiency, you basically don't have a lot of breast development. So IGF-1 is extremely important for breast development and for estrogen action. Sometimes, if the IGF-1 is very high, you can actually have an increase in cancer risk. And if the IGF-1 is quite low, you can have a decrease in cancer risk. Dwarfs have a major decrease in cancer risk, and people with overproduction of these hormones have an increase in cancer risk. So based on that, we have been working together with my colleagues, Deborah and Julia. We've been working on trying to understand whether inhibition of IGF-1 might be helpful in treating breast cancer or preventing breast cancer. And we've actually started a clinical trial with a drug which is no longer active, although we are applying for a new grant, in which we give an IGF-1 inhibitor and see what happens. I can tell you that we've had some patients whose tumors have gotten smaller, and we've had a couple of patients whose tumors have gone away. This is in a very, very small sample and should not be taken as the end-all and be-all until further studies are done. But we do believe that blocking IGF-1 action might be helpful in particularly reducing the incidence of DCIS. And now, as Julia and Deborah have told you, that most women with DCIS are put under are asked to have surgery on the tumors and radiation and tamoxifen or other SERMs. Our concept is that if we could reduce the incidence of DCIS, that we would really reduce the pool of patients who then had to have all of these all of these therapies. So we hope that in the long run we'll be able to say that we can or we can't reduce the incidence of DCIS, and hopefully with a medical treatment, because a medical treatment would avoid having to have surgery and radiation and SERMs, probably. So I think that there is hope, but I don't want to say that we're anywhere near completely understanding this, but we are working on this concept.
And we also have looked at it in women with precancer or atypia, and we have found that by using this growth factor inhibitor, that it did slow the growth of tumors and increase cell death, which is, you know, what one of the goals of the study was.
Right, and we know that it makes sense because we have the data from any anti-estrogen. IGF-1 inhibition inhibits more emphatically and more purposefully, but all the SERMs, tamoxifen, and all the studies with the SERMs show that if you decrease the ability of estrogen to attach to the breast cell, you will decrease the incidence of breast cancer. And we published, we published a study a few years ago using letrozole, an aromatase inhibitor, which more effectively in the postmenopausal woman inhibits breast, inhibits estrogen attachment to the breast cells, and that showed a effect on surrogate markers for prevention of breast cancer. So all of this makes a lot of sense, and as David said, that is our hope, is that we will be able to find a medical prevention and not have to use surgery and radiation.
Julia, you're using the word prevention, and clearly that's what CIRMS and letrozole does. I think that there's a possibility that that since IGF-1 inhibition blocks estrogen action, but also has major effects on other functions in the breast, like migration and invasion, angiogenesis, and genomic stability, that that not using an estrogen inhibitor, but using something else that has further action, might have a greater hope of being effective in treating, besides prevention of breast cancer.
Yes, I absolutely agree, and I think other studies that have looked at the immune microenvironment of high-risk versus low-risk lesions, looking at activated macrophages, activated T cells, these are also, extremely important. And that just points to the multifactorial issues involved in the development of a breast cell becoming transforming to a tumor cell. So there will be estrogen effects, and the estrogen effects will interact with all these other immune and microenvironment and genomic factors, as you've pointed out.
There's a study, and it reminds me what Julia talked about of our letrozole study, which was a positive study in women with precancerous or atypical lesions. This is a study that is open for accrual. By Dr. Shelley Wang. It's called the CALGB 40903 study, and it's looking at women with new diagnosis of intraductal cancer, and they're using MRI, and they're giving letrozole for 6 months, and then they're doing the surgery and to look at the effects of letrozole as we had looked at in the precancerous settings. So I think that's a very interesting trial that you can, I guess, get the information online from the NCI cancer.gov website.
What are the future directions for DCIS?
Well, there you go. There's one of them.
Right.
I think that's totally interesting.
Right.
What did you say?
Well, let me ask you another question then. Can you make one prediction about DCIS, each of you?
Well, if you want my prediction, I think that IGF-1 inhibition is going to be effective, at least in the low-grade lesions.
My prediction is that DCIS will no longer be called DCIS. It will be divided into specific cancer subtypes and non-cancer subtypes, and we will treat each one individually with targeted therapy that will not involve any of the treatments that are currently our standard of care.
So I think that as a clinician, we're going to look more at young age and race, black women being treated more aggressively since they, have a significantly higher risk of dying from DCIS. And so I think that we'll be more aggressive with that treatment, less aggressive with others. I think we'll use less radiation as more women become informed about some of the more indolent behavior of DCIS, that we'll do less bilateral mastectomy, and if we do it, that people will understand what it does and doesn't do. How it's effective for certain things, but not effective for overall survival.
Thank you so
much. We'll have less work. Surgeons will have less work, which is a good thing.
That was a good thing. So now we're ready to take questions from our listeners. To ask a question, if you're listening by phone, just press 1. And if you're streaming online, call us at 646-668-8070 and then press 1. Beth is going to identify you with your area code and exchange.
Thank you, Ivis, and thank you, doctors. It was a great presentation. So it looks like we do have a question from a caller at 917-763. Go right ahead, caller. What's your question?
Thank you. Good afternoon, doctors. My question is, I am a DCIS patient. I was diagnosed in 2008. I have been on tamoxifen ever since. I did have lumpectomy radiation and have been on tamoxifen ever since. I am now facing a possible uterine cancer. I will have a hysteroscopy and a DNC next Friday to remove the tumor in question. And my doctor, my oncologist, took me off tamoxifen immediately upon learning this. I am 53 years old. I do not know if I am menopausal yet because I've had crazy spotting and staining that I can't explain, and now I believe it's related to this issue. I would like to break free of tamoxifen now that I think it has caused this uterine damage, and can I be successfully safe going forward if I no longer go back on tamoxifen?
Well, that is, you know, that's a question that requires really investigating the original diagnosis carefully. And, you know, I understand that it's obviously extremely upsetting to have to deal with this uterine issue. But, as you know, I think one of the most important takeaway messages from what we're all saying on this program is that, you know, to date, this, although we all have enormous hope that we can identify these subsets and identify patients who do not need aggressive treatment or treatment at all, to date, all the studies have shown that until now that, you know, we do decrease, and even now, we do decrease the incidence of invasive breast cancers, contralateral and recurrent breast cancers with the treatment you have had. So, you know, that so that may have been a totally appropriate, certainly was in 2008, and it still may be a totally appropriate approach for your disease. It's always a risk when you put someone on tamoxifen that that there could be a uterine abnormality, including a cancer developed. That risk is small. It exists, but it's small, and it pales in comparison to the risk of one of these other breast events. So you have to kind of keep all of this in that original context. The other point is that, you know, most, if as your doctor is clearly watching closely, and that's what should be done when someone's on anything like tamoxifen, and they've picked up early that you undoubtedly have some kind of endometrial thickening of the endometrial lining, and they're going to look and see what that's due to. It may just be hyperplasia, or it may be that there are early cancer cells. Those are almost always totally curable. So you have to keep that context. Now, as to whether you can go off the tamoxifen after this, again, that it sounds like that's the way your course is heading. But the final decision about whether your treatment's over has to rest with a really thorough investigation of what the original tumor was, what as much as understanding as you can about what those features, those pathologic, histologic, and biologic features that we were talking about were. And, you know, whether there has to be any continued anti-estrogen therapy now. Does that help you?
But if you adhere, Julia, if you adhere, though, to the reason for or the background for putting her on the tamoxifen, it was
the NSABP B24 study looking at 5 years of tamoxifen.
Right.
As
but
beneficial.
Did she have microinvasion? Did she not? How, what, you know, what did the, you know, we just don't know at this point what they found at pathology.
But if you were diagnosed in 08, I think that you had what we know is the benefit of tamoxifen in, you know, if we extrapolate from the study.
Yeah.
So
it would be
very reasonable
to
do
going on.
Only 5 years.
Yeah.
And so that would mean staying off the tamoxifen.
Yeah. It sounds like she's heading that way. And you know, the 10-year has only, the extension of 10 years of tamoxifen has only been shown to be valuable in people with invasive breast cancer.
Yeah.
So you know, from what you're saying, it doesn't sound like you fall into that group. But I'm just saying as a caveat to be sure that, you know, you go over this and your doctor goes over this carefully and that there was nothing that's pushing him to give you, to have been thinking about more extended use.
Yes,
okay.
I did. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks so much for that question. We've got another question coming in from 212713. Go right ahead, caller. What's your question?
Yes, good afternoon, Drs. Axelrod, Smith, and Kleinberg. Dr. Axelrod found my calcifications about 7 years ago, and I am a DCIS survivor. My question is, 2 years ago...
I don't know if I recognize your phone number.
Well, I'm calling from work. I probably don't, but my name is Maria. I have a new doctor now up at... Columbia, but I was at NYU, and you did find my calcification, which turned into DCIS about 2 years ago. So I've been on tamoxifen for 2 years, and I just need the clarity of when I get off tamoxifen in 3 more years, which will be my total of 5 years, will I be classified as cancer-free?
Presumably, you are classified as cancer-free at this point. If you had calcifications that then, you know, if you had calcifications that turned out to be nothing, and then later you had a diagnosis of DCIS, and then you got on tamoxifen for that diagnosis of DCIS, then that tamoxifen is being used to prevent these breast events that we were talking about earlier. So it's being used to prevent, another breast cancer in that same breast, a breast cancer in the other breast. And that's the point of the tamoxifen. So it is, you know, a preventative therapy in that kind of a case. And that you should think of yourself as cancer-free at this point, but that doesn't mean that your risk of another cancer is zero. That's the distinction, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, the majority of calcifications are benign,
right.
So that's a good thing, because I think if you look at basically all mammograms will show some type of calcium. It's when they cluster and become, they look kind of bizarre. That's when you start to worry about it. One of the take-home messages from the editorial by Laura Esserman was that, we have to start rethinking biopsying all of these calcifications because there's a high recall rate and a high biopsy rate, particularly in older women. So that would be something that breast imagers should... From this study by NARod should really be reassured by the low mortality rate, the low, you know, death rate associated with a DCIS diagnosis.
And it's very important not to think that calcifications on mammogram indicate cancer or cancer risk. They do not. Calcifications on mammogram, we pay attention to them only because most calcifications are benign. They're not related to cancer. But some cancers form calcifications. And so if the calcifications are in a random, completely benign formation, then the radiologist will say, don't worry about these. They're calcifications and they're benign. If the calcifications are not in that random, clearly benign formation, the radiologist will say, I can't say that it's just random and benign. Why don't you take a look and biopsy these, because there could be a cancer. But even many of those calcifications turn out to be benign. So calcifications themselves do not mean cancer, and they do not mean that cancer will form in those calcifications.
All right. That was thanks so much for that question, caller. If we have anyone else who wants to ask a question, just dial 646-668-8070. Press 1. In the meantime, Deb Hackenberry.
Can I just say one thing about
Sure.
You know, the evolution, I just want to say about the evolution of liveal carcinoma in situ. So when I started my career in 1982, women with liveal carcinoma in situ, now known as a marker for cancer, were undergoing bilateral mastectomies. And, you know, it was, you know, years later that people understood that this was a marker, and now we can offer what's called chemo prevention to these women. You know, we use it as a marker, and we look at their risk. We look at the, you know, Julia will look at not only the diagnosis of LCIS, or liveal carcinoma in situ, which is not really a cancer, but it, you know, the other risk factors in their life and their family history, and then decide whether or not they should have some kind of targeted therapy, which is not really a therapy, but a prevention. And I think that that's where we're going with DCIS.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you. I think Deb Hackenberry had a couple of questions as well.
Sure. I co-facilitate the support group for women with DCIS, and one of the main issues that drives a lot of the women to our group is assuming that they have estrogen receptor positive DCIS, is they're not sure whether or not they want to take a targeted therapy, and that seems to be a really big question for them. What are your thoughts?
Wait, I'm not sure I understood. You're saying, Deb, that one of their main issues is after they've been diagnosed with DCIS is whether they should take a tamoxifen-like therapy.
Right. They've had either a lumpectomy and radiation or a mastectomy,
right.
And now their doctors are suggesting that they go on a targeted therapy, either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor, and they're really, in many cases, reluctant to do that, or there's, at the very least, they're really searching for information to determine whether they think they should or not.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's you know, it is a difficult question, and not everyone, as we've been talking about, you know, and that this NARod article that Deborah mentioned, not everybody will probably need anti-estrogen therapy.
Well, you know, in the NARod study, actually, since it's from the SEER data, there was no information on tamoxifen. So we don't even know of those 110,000 women who, you know, who had DCIS, what tamoxifen, who was on tamoxifen, who wasn't, and of the 3% of women who succumbed with a history of DCIS, whether or not they were on tamoxifen. So it's a hard decision, and I think there are different permutations of what you. Of what we're going to be talking about in the future, maybe lumpectomy and tamoxifen for an ER-positive tumor, tamoxifen only,
the margins are also critical. How did they do with, you know?
Well, they didn't have the margin
right.
status in this
exactly.
very big study. I mean, there were certainly
right.
limitations. So that's why I don't think that we can adapt this as, you know, in general, as the way we treat DCIS. I mean, things can change on, you know, the you know, overnight. Just look at what HRT did and breast cancer, you know, in the early 2000s. But I think that we have to be very circumspect about how we handle the information. And I agree with Laura Esserman in her editorial that we have to be very thoughtful now about looking at DCIS maybe as a marker in certain circumstances, not in the young, maybe not in black women, maybe, you know, there are certain subsets of people where you do have to be more aggressive. But I think that it shakes things up to the point where we really have to be more thoughtful.
Yeah, and I think for your question, Deb, about, you know, whether they should take an anti-estrogen or not, you know, it just comes down to understanding all of these issues, understanding that we don't have a real, you know, a clinical study basis for not prescribing that yet, but that we're moving toward that in certain cases. And then there are other life, you know, quality of life and lifestyle issues that are important in each case. So obviously, you know, if you take tamoxifen, you cannot get pregnant. So if the woman has not had children and wants to have children, that's an important thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
If you take an aromatase inhibitor and you have an underlying, you know, bone mineral density problem, osteoporosis, you can have more problems. So you sort of have to factor all of these other things in. But as Deborah was saying, you know, it's really important to know that, you know, this pushback is good as a general philosophical idea, but we have to be very cautious about removing treatments when we have clearly improved our detection and our survival so dramatically in the last 20 to 30 years.
Yeah, and we're also going to learn more about the benefits of aromatase inhibitors and tamoxifen and DCIS with the B35 study.
Right.
So, I mean, there are still studies that are maturing. There is still information that we need to have. But I think there's also the information of if you have an ER-positive tumor, do you want to address the risk? Maybe not the actual cancer, but do you want to address the risk? Right, Julia? I mean,
yes.
I think that's kind
yes.
of an interesting...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's maybe like a more philosophical question
right.
than just
yeah.
about the tumor itself.
Can I ask a question here? I think that we were talking before about ER-negative tumors. Are we thinking that people with ER-negative tumors should take tamoxifen?
No, we're just talking...
We're
the people
talking
who
about
are...
But I think that...
Yeah,
maybe,
are ER-positive. The ER, which are most
I think,
of the
I, yeah,
women.
I think we have to be very specific about ER-positive versus ER-negative. It could have been misinterpreted.
Oh, right. So the people that we would offer hormonal therapy to would be the ones who have ER-positive tumors.
Great.
Julia?
Thank you.
That's something we've known, you know, obviously we want to clarify that if it wasn't clear. That's, you know, those two correlate closely, and you're not going to likely prevent anything in a patient who's got an ER-negative DCIS by giving them, you know, an estrogen, anti-estrogen treatment.
Great, thank you. Deb, did you have another question before we close?
Given that DCIS is generally classified as stage zero cancer, is a sentinel biopsy necessary with a DCIS lumpectomy or mastectomy?
Okay, that'd be me. So the reason I don't advocate for sentinel with lumpectomy because you can go back and do it if you find invasion. So the sentinel is axillary staging, and when we have invasive cancer, we want to know if cancer is spread to the lymph node because it affects possibly the prognosis and also may direct different treatment. But with intraductal cancer, there's no need to stage the axilla because the axilla should be negative. The question is, why do people have it? There are some surgeons that will do a sentinel node with high-grade DCIS because they feel that there's a higher risk of finding invasion. I'm of the mindset that with a lumpectomy, you could do you could just excise the lesion and then if there's no invasion, you don't have to go in there again. If you're going to have a mastectomy, I like to do the sentinel node, because if you find invasion, first of all, if you're doing a mastectomy, usually it's because it's either more extensive or there's a lot of high-grade cancer, so there's more of a chance of finding invasion. But if you do a mastectomy and don't do the sentinel and then find the invasion later, then your chance of finding the sentinel node, if you take someone back after mastectomy, it is not as good. You know, it technically, it it's harder to find that sentinel node. So that's why I do it when I'm doing mastectomy. And there are usually reasons to do that mastectomy, because it's usually either a lot of DCIS, that's one of the associations with the extent of DCIS increases the likelihood of finding invasive cancer.
Okay, thank you. Are there any final questions, Deb or Ivis?
I guess I have one more question. How difficult is it to get clear margins with a DCIS lumpectomy?
Deborah, that's you.
So I think that, number one, we look at margins a little differently now, but that's more for invasive cancer. There's the American Society of Breast Surgeons has put out a consensus about what to adapt as an acceptable margin. We've gone from a centimeter down to, greater than a millimeter, and some trials have used not on ink, which is, I don't think, very good to use that. But I think that now that we've changed the way we look at margins, we go back less for margins. And with that said, so that is not, there's no consensus out yet about DCIS. It's only about invasive cancer. But we've been using something called a margin probe. It's actually very helpful. It's cut my rates down for re-excision, so I like it. It looks at the electrical differences between the gradient of the cancer cells and the non-cancer cells. So we started using it at NYU and have published on it, and it's FDA approved. I think it's interesting. I think that there's still a risk of having to go back, and I think people need to know that when they go in for a lumpectomy, that there is a small chance that you have to go back and take out more tissue. But I don't think that, it's 30%, it's more like 10%, the risk of a re-excision. So I think it's gotten much less as we adapt to less margin width, and that we can also use this margin probe.
Great. Thank you so much. Ivis, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Beth. And I personally want to thank Drs. Axelrod, Smith, and Kleinberg for a wonderful presentation and conversation on all that is going on with DCIS today. I know there's been a lot of media attention to this and a lot of confusion, and I think you were able to clarify very much for the women and their family members and friends who are listening today. So thank you once again.
I'm sorry, Ivis. It looks like we do have one last-minute question. Do we have time for that?
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Okay,
please.
Let's just take that question. This is from 202268. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I was diagnosed in July of last year with DCIS, estrogen receptor positive, sentinel nodes with no lymph node involvement. I had clear margins. 6 weeks of radiation therapy, and now on tamoxifen. And I had also an onco type score of 17. I joined the presentation a little bit late. I don't know if you had any discussion on the use of that onco test.
Okay.
Well, that's actually
How old are you?
I'm 46. Diagnosed at 45.
Okay.
I think the oncotype is very interesting. Just as a background, we use it in invasive cancer to predict. It's a continuous variable that looks at the genetic makeup of the tumor itself. So they look at the tumor tissue, and you get a specific number that tells you over the next 10 years what the risk of cancer spreading to other
sites of the body so that it helps decide whether or not you need an anti-estrogen or chemotherapy and an anti-estrogen. So you have to going in there with a estrogen receptor positive tumor. But the oncotype for DCIS is different. The oncotype is looking at whether or not it can predict for your risk of recurrence locally, you know, meaning if you have a very low score, do you really need the radiation? And if you have an intermediate score, which is, I think, with a 17, what you had, would be recommended to have the radiation. So it's kind of a just helpful for the local control of DCIS.
These, you know, the Oncotype scores in whether it's for invasive or for DCIS, what they are trying to do is they, as Deborah said, they take the tumor tissue and then they analyze a set of genes in that tumor itself, and those genes are things that tell you something about how rapidly the DNA is dividing, the proliferation of the tumor cells, some of the sort of housekeeping genes to keep things up and running in the system, that kind of thing. And, you know, we have a lot of hope for these genomic analyses to give us a good indication about, you know, valid and true indication about what treatment is absolutely necessary and what is not. But with the DCIS, none of that has yet been truly validated. So it's good to you know, explore these things, but it does sound as though you had the appropriate treatment for what your particular case was.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to give it back to you and Ivis.
Well, I'll thank everyone once again. As always, there's many questions and there's a lot of information, and I want to thank Drs. Axelrod, Smith, and Kleinberg for all the great information you gave us today, and thank everyone for joining us. If you want to refer to the show later, please visit our website for a link, or you can email Beth at bkling@sharecancersupport.org. And once again, everyone, thank you. And hopefully you will have a wonderful day and you have a lot of information. And doctors, you were absolutely on target. We'd like to thank you at Share for all that you do for the patients that you're working with. Thank you, everyone.
Our pleasure,
thank
and thank you,
you
to Share.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.